Number one, Star Wars. Number two, comics. Number three, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Number four, Mario. Number five, Weird Al. Number six, Batman. Number seven, Kal-El. Number eight, The Simpsons. Number nine, TV. Number ten, every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but before they all sold out, say it all together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Say nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Nerds Ruin Everything. I'm Logan.
And I'm Adam.
And we're going to talk about some Looney Tunes, because there's news and also a movie that just came out that Adam saw last week. Finally got to see it this week. But we also want to talk about Daredevil and Righteous Gemstones proper, because that, even though it started 2 weeks ago, the actual show started this week. And you said you had a couple of things. I had something that you've talked about that I did get to watch. So, very, very briefly, I binged the entire season of Running Point in a night. You're right. It's really good. I don't think it's great, but I want to like Mindy Kaling. I didn't watch the... Was it the Mindy Project?
The Mindy Kaling Project? Yeah. The Mindy Project.
I didn't really watch that. So, I don't have a good handle on her as a creator outside of The Office. Because I think my only other, experience is Velma, which is terrible. This is certainly better than Velma. But it's not, it's missing a little something to make it truly, truly excellent.
Yeah. It's a good starting point, right? I think I said, they're getting a second season and I'm actually kind of excited because I think that they'll figure out what worked and what didn't in the first season. And I think what didn't work, to be perfectly honest, is Max Greenfield. And I'm kind of glad that it feels like they're going to give him the light shove off. I think that they were trying to figure out whether Greenfield and her or Jay Ellis and her had chemistry, and it's not even a contest. The way that it's written, Jay Ellis is definitely this is something that I find very interesting, which is that whenever I'm watching a TV show, for the most part, I kind of want them to adhere to my moral standards, and my moral standards are that you don't usually shit where you eat, so you don't get involved with office romances. But occasionally, if the writing is there, I totally want office romances because it doesn't take away. And this is a show where you want them just to kind of stay with the core group and at the job. Taking her into this whole Max Greenfield relationship kind of took it away.
Yeah, it wound up being the most boring part of the show.
Absolutely.
So, I think Ellis just works. He's so fun and charismatic and just, has this kind of, loose cannon kind of thing going on. And there's just not enough of him. I think it does a disservice to us, we're supposed to feel like we know these basketball players, and for the most part, you really don't. When Ted Lasso, which, since we're talking sports stuff, Ted Lasso confirmed season four coming maybe end of next year, depending on, I'm assuming they have scripts, that's why it's confirmed. So probably shooting by end of this year, release by end of next year, probably. We'll see. But I feel like Ted Lasso is a good comp for this show. It's Netflix trying to get in that kind of thing. And this does do a lot of things that Ted Lasso does. But the one thing Ted Lasso does that this doesn't is build that relationship with the players and it makes you feel like you really know them, so that when you get into that personal stuff, there's real emotion there, and not like, oh, I'm supposed to just care about this or, you know, have some kind of feeling for this person. This show, like, they show up, they do little things. Like, she gives that speech in the locker room towards the end, and yeah, like, references certain players, and I'm like, I have no, like, none of what you're saying was really there on screen.
No, it hadn't been earned, and I think that that's what's going to be the thing that they're going to work on this season. Like, I think that, like I said, like, I feel like season two, it's very easy to see what worked and what didn't, and I feel like the family stuff kind of worked. I really wish that they hadn't, like, gotten this whole thing of, oh, okay, well, Justin Theroux is going to be back, and he's going to be an asshole, and that's what's going to be the tension. There's enough tension with the players and her, and her having to solve problems. That's what I loved about the show. Her and Brenda Song, like, are the 1-2 comedy Obi and Shaq, like, punch that I just want to see all the time.
It is, you know, for lack of a better phrasing, it's a female-centric version of the Ted and Beard dynamic that really, absolutely, really works. Like, it's a friendship kind of chemistry that, honestly, is really difficult to capture. Like, you really, really have to nail that, and they absolutely do. Another show it kind of reminded me of is the one it's another Apple Plus show. I just drew a blank on the name. Where she gets all that money and then starts with Maya Rudolph.
Oh, No. I know what you're talking about. Oh gosh. What's it called? It's something like, but yeah, no, it definitely kind of different workplace. Workplace like show. Oh gosh. What is it called? I'm looking it up right now. Oh, it's going to be so stupid that I don't. Loot. That's what it's called.
Yeah, that's it. Loot. Yeah. I can't believe I blanked on the freaking name.
As soon as you did, like, it's like Contagious. Like, I did too. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, crap, what is it called? That one. Yeah, it definitely, it's got that, like, it in a weird way. And I mean, because it makes no, like, it doesn't, I mean, they both worked on The Office. It's very Michael Schur-ish.
Yeah.
But it's not as, like, Michael Schur at this point, like, first season, it's off the ground and running. Like, Mindy Kaling's show, like, it has some work to do, right? Like, they're still like, okay, well, if they adjust this and just that, they're trying things out, and they know this. And so, like, if they get a season two, we know it's going to be a very different show. And I'm okay with that, right? Like, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, it's like you can see the seams very easily in this show, and nothing wrong.
She's a great lead, though. Like, she really is. Yeah. It kind of gives you some, like, I know she made a lot of money off those rom-coms. I know it did a lot for a specific, like, set, like, point of her career. But it also makes you, I think you said this when you talked about it. You look at her and go, like, yeah, we missed out on, like, 15 years of her not being just this, like, romantic lead in a rom-com.
Yeah, it's really kind of shitty, right? Like, you realize it when you watch something like Almost Famous. You go, fuck, we should have really had, like, 15 years of solid dramatic or dramedy work. Like all the,
I mean, stuff, you brought up her showing up in the Ryan Johnson movie.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, and like that was a big, like I don't want to. It sounds weird to say big swing, because it really shouldn't be seen that way. But no. coming off of everything she had done, like big picture wise, like that was a, it was a big swing because it was outside what people want to say is her wheelhouse. And this certainly is like, I mean, it's got me, like I'm in for season two, especially like where it winds up. I think it's a lot of fun. It was apparently easy as hell to binge. Like I sat down, the circumstances were Stephanie was at work. I was hanging out at her place all week. And she had, like a bookshelf kind of thing that she had ordered. And I was like, I'm going to put this together. I was like, I'm going to watch something while I put this together. This shouldn't take 30 or 45 minutes. It took me longer, but, I was like, I'm going to put on Running Point. I had Netflix booted up. I was like, I'm going to watch this. Adam said it was really good. And it was probably 2.5 episodes before I got the bookshelf done. And by then I was just like, this is pretty good. And I just like, then I made myself some food and watched some more. And before I knew it, I was on like episode 8 and I was like, well, I guess I'm watching the whole series.
Yeah. It's very bingeable because it's just, I don't know. It's light. It's breezy. It's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. You know, and the cast is like super on point. Oh, like it's not just her.
She's great, but Scott MacArthur is like the fucking MVP of this show.
Oh goodness.
Like,
oh God.
He's the guy, like the guy, you know, from anything and everything, because he is just that character actor. I don't think that there's a sitcom in the last 10 years that he hasn't shown up in at some point. Including Righteous Gemstones that we're going to talk about in a few minutes. But I don't know. He's just so, I don't know if we've ever seen play like a super wealthy vapid dipshit. And like watching it here is a lot of fun. He plays really, he's the kind of guy that can play well off of anybody. Like he's just so good at that. And
no, he is.
So
he
whatever really scene he's in with whoever he's in it with, like there's in one of the episodes, like her, him and the little brother whose name I forget, he's Sandy. Okay. I didn't love him as much. Like,
yeah,
they confront, they're confronting her about something that she's not gonna do. And like the little brother's like running off of the mouth and Scott MacArthur, he's like, I forgot what I was gonna say. And he just repeats everything except louder.
Yes. And
I like, it's such a stupid little gimmick, but he makes it work so well. It's fucking ridiculous.
He really does. Like, it's really fucking like, it's the chemistry, right? Like, even when, like, you know, Sandy, I feel like Sandy is designed to be hated until the end because he's such an uptight little shitwad.
Then you wind up hating him anyway because then he goes back and treats Jackie like a piece of shit again.
Exactly. Yeah, like it's great. Like it, like what I love about it is it's a good ensemble, and they give everybody, like everybody in this show, including, can we just talk for 2 seconds about how good Chet Hanks is in this fucking show and how unexpected it is? I mean, he's playing basically Chet Hanks.
He's playing Chet Hanks if Chet Hanks was a basketball player. Exactly. And it's fucking wild. Like, they let him do the rapping thing that, like, and he gets an emotional arc that you don't really expect. And he does, he nails it. Like, whether if it's like him just playing a version of him and that's the only thing he can do, but he does it really fucking well.
Oh my God, he does it well. And like, there's this thing where he telegraphs stuff that you, or maybe it's just his persona, like when they go to the restaurant and you absolutely know it's headed into the wrong direction.
Yeah.
Like, thing of like, oh no, don't do
it. He's gonna kiss her.
Yeah. And you go, oh shit, he is gonna kiss her. Don't fucking call. And you're just, but the great thing about it is that Mindy Kaling writing staff are so smart is that they somehow magically get you to, like, and here's, I'm going to say something. I feel like sometimes charm can be inherited, and I feel like Chet has been so against his father's, like he doesn't want to be his dad, right? He doesn't want to be an charming guy. He's like, no, I'm going to talk the bumper clock and do everything that you don't want him to do. And like somehow the writers and the directors of this show, when they hired him, were like, just give us a little bit of affability. Give us a little bit of the riz. And he gives just enough to where at the end, when she takes him to, spoilers, guys, skip this part. When she takes him to rehab, or even when he starts going through the rehab, like the drug stuff.
Yeah.
You're on his side. You're not like, oh, fuck this dude. I want this dude to fail. You're like, no, come on, dude. Come on. Let's like, I want to see you succeed. I want to see you go into rehab. And it's kind of like, I would say it's the writing, but it's also kind of Chet himself,
He's very affable. Like, it works really well.
Yeah. I mean, so much stuff that, like, you know, like, even when he's being, like, that's one of my favorite things is, like the whole thing of, like, the rookie's going to have to pay for the restaurant, which is a real-life thing. Like, the thing that I like about the show is that it takes real-life things that, like, NBA fans know about. Like, I mean, any sports fans know about, like, how they treat each other, the locker room and stuff. And they make it a story. And they make it, like, this whole thing of, like, the vet has to come in and kind of, like, set things straight and shit. And it's, like, it's the kind of thing that you like to see in a show that you know about. But oftentimes people, like the writers, aren't fans of the sport or even fans of sports, and they just go, you want, like, I mean, we know the shows that we're talking about, like, you know, the ones that don't have writers that knew fucking anything about a sport.
But they're not all multimillionaires. Like, they're just not, you know.
Exactly. And that's kind of like the thing that I love about the show is that it shows it does class in a really interesting way. Like, it's something that we don't often talk about, like, about, like, you know, about, like, super rich and, like, super poor. Like, one of my favorite things was, and it's so heartbreaking to watch it, is the way that Jackie is treated. But it's also very much, what he gets, like, my favorite storyline is when he realizes, I'm a Gordon. And what does he do? He does what any 21-year-old does and fucks everything in sight. And then what happens? There's a consequence for that. But then his buddy, who's not really his buddy, but also gives him the best advice, is that, who is it? It's Steven Ramirez, the guy who's the chairman of the board.
Yep.
He goes, you have to be better than them. You are a Gordon, but you're not a Gordon. And you never will be. And it's hard. But then when fucking Sandy says what he fucking says, it's just that reminder. And it's like,
ouch. Or they do it to him when she's having like a meltdown about everything. And she's like, sorry, this is family only. And it's like, but he's family. So, yeah. It's a lot of good storylines. There's some weird leaps it has to take to get there that happen real fast, like him becoming a Gordon, you know, like finding that, like in the first episode, it's just like, what the hell is this kid doing in here? And they like speed that up really quick so that by the middle of the second episode, it's just like, oh, okay. So now he's working there. But once you're in the world, it's fine.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And like I said, like, it's got this winning cast that you, like, she does what The Office does. Like, she definitely has that skill set, right? Like, Mindy in the writer's room do the thing that we love about The Office, which is, like 20% hatred, like 80% love, right? Where we'll love a character for 80% of the time, and then they'll do something so human, but so trashy, that you're like, But it does it in a way that I feel like isn't as skeevy as, like, say, The Office. Because sometimes The Office could go low. They could go real low. Like, I was watching, I can't even remember what episode I was watching of The Office. It's one of the ones where, what's his name is sleeping with, sleeps with Angela after, after Andy, or no, it's not Andy. I can't think of his name. Ed Helms's character, like
yeah,
him
it's
and
Andy.
Yeah, it's Andy. Okay. Yeah. And it was just like, that's so fucking dirty and skeevy. I just don't like, it makes you like, this show doesn't make you hate people. It just makes you go, fuck, why did you do that? Why? Yeah. You could have done the right thing. But all the same, like, it's like, I really do like the show. I'm glad that it's coming back for a second season. And I'm glad that you enjoyed it. Like, you know, and there's room to, right?
Yeah. It uses its like very minor characters really well. Like,
yes,
Jim O'Hare like steps in for a very small role. Oh God, what's his freaking name from another Parks and Rec vet?
Which one?
Damn it. Shit. He's the radio guy, John Glazer.
Yes, John Glazer. Oh God, who plays basically every like,
fucking Smith half-assed. Yeah.
Yes, bust-ass asshole.
And so he's great. He's so good at that. Like he was when he showed up. I was like, I loved. Like John Glazer is so at home just playing the douchebag. So
yeah. And he plays it so well, and he's got that weird neck beard bullshit that it's great. Like I love like everything he's like, even though he's spewing the most sexist vile shit, it's so great because it's a great counterpoint to
You know, there's a whole thing in the episodes about everybody keeps mispronouncing her name. But yeah, it was a good recommend. I was glad I watched it. I'm probably going to rewatch it because I'm probably going to sit down and Steph doesn't have Netflix. So I'm going to sit down and we're going to watch it with my Netflix. So okay. I just introduced her to Ted Lasso this weekend too. I was like, season 4 is coming sometime next year, so you got to watch Ted Lasso with me now. So she also has made a concerted effort to get caught up on Righteous Gemstones.
that's hardcore. Because that's 4 seasons of very tough things to actually like, very challenging comedy, especially in the second season. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You're gonna keep me appraised about how that goes, and we'll talk about that.
She's in for it. She's completely caught up. Like she.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. In like a week, she watched the entire show. So.
Oh damn. That is hardcore parkour, man.
Yeah. She's in for it though. She loves it.
Oh man. Okay. We will get to that in a second, but I wanted to like throw something at you to see if you have heard of it and if you have started it, which is. Have you probably did because you're from the thing that I knew it from, which is, have you heard about the Netflix series, The Residence?
Okay, so I watched 5 minutes of it and then I stopped it because I was like, it's going to be an hour long thing.
Yes.
This is something that we may enjoy watching together. So I don't want to get too into it and then like go back to it. Because the 5 minutes I saw, I was like, the trailer plus like the first 5 minutes of the first episode, I was like, I think I'm going to like this show.
Yeah, you probably will, because we watched the first 3 episodes and we're kind of in love with it. It is very much it's a murder mystery. Like for those that you guys that don't know, it's a murder mystery that's set at the White House and the executive usher, basically the chief usher. Ushers are like workers within the White House, and the chief usher is the the lead one, basically the guy who runs the entire White House like staff. Not the appointed staff, but the actual staff, like the plumbers, the carpenters, the chefs,
all the day-to-day mundane shit that, like, politically, barring outside of the current administration, probably, yeah, politically really shouldn't matter. How they vote is not.
They're employed. They're not. Yeah. They're employed. They're not appointed. Like, which actually becomes a very, very point, very early on, it becomes a point of contention. It's very interesting, but it is I can tell you, we started it at here's the thing, old man, Kelzer. I'm a dude that goes to bed very early. I go to bed at if 10 o'clock, even on a Sunday or like on a Friday, is a little bit late for me. We started it at 9, expecting at 10 we would be one episode. We went until midnight watching the first 3 episodes. That's how good and addictive this show is, because it's very okay. So the kind of show it is it's the kind of show that every episode is named after a mystery show.
I was about to ask you if you noticed what the naming routine was. So when I was looking at the episodes on Netflix, I was like, oh, they named every episode after a murder mystery, like either movie or book or story or what have you. So
absolutely. It's that kind of cleverness of a show. Like, the thing that I would actually compare it to is Knives Out. It literally is like Rian Johnson's Knives Out series. They even kind of call to it. They make a callback to it. Where
one of the episodes is called Knives Out, right?
Yes, it is. This is the last one that we watch. Ken Marino, who's on fire on this show, playing the dick of all dick bags.
I got to see him for 2 seconds. Oh. It was pretty fucking funny.
Oh, my God. Wait till you see Jason Lee. Like, Jason Lee has come to destroy.
Is fucking insane.
When you watch the show, you absolutely understand why they got this goddamn cast, because it is so good. The writing is.
You've got Julian McMahon on top of Uzo Aduba, I think is how you say your name, which everybody would just know as Crazy Eyes from Orange is the New Black. But she's such a great actress. Julian McMahon and Al Franken as a politician, is
playing basically the role that he's.
Yeah, it's kind of genius.
Oh, my God. You've got guys fucking Bronson Pinchot,
yeah,
doing an accent. Oh my God. The last episode I watched was all about his fucking character. And I swear to God.
Kylie Minogue is such a weird pull. Giancarlo Esposito, I think he's only in one or two episodes, right?
No.
Is he in the whole show? Oh, okay.
Yeah, because he plays. Okay, so he plays the body, but there's flashbacks.
Saw the first 5 minutes. I was like, oh, it was a cool little cameo that he, but okay. So it's going to flash back to him. Gotcha.
No, absolutely. The worst part is I was I need to read more about this. And so the worst part about this is that I found out who played it for a couple of episodes. Then the strike happened, and then he passed away.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Man.
And literally, when you watch the show, Giancarlo is literally, it's...
That happened with Luther, with him playing Lex Luthor. That's how he got... Giancarlo Esposito's schedule was full, so they cast... I just drew a blank on his name. They cast him as Lex Luthor in Kite Man.
Yes.
And then he passed away.
Yep. And so, yeah, if you don't, I'm not going to ruin it, because it kind of sets this on like this uneven, because if you're a fan, you'd be like, oh fuck, really? It was a so, but Giancarlo is magnificent. Like, regardless of that,
I know Jane Curtin's in it because, like, I saw her in the first few minutes. You already mentioned Jason Lee, Randall Park. I didn't get to Randall Park showing up yet.
He doesn't show up until like the second episode, but when he does, he plays the Lakeith Stanfield part from Knives Out.
Molly Griggs. Like the
Molly Griggs is in it. Isaiah Whitlock Jr. is in it. Like playing exactly what you expect him to play, a cop. Mary Wiseman, I don't know if you I found her and she's cute as a button. Like, she's so fucking, like, not in this show. This show, she plays a chef, but she, like, if you've seen her in Star Trek Discovery, you know who she is. She is. She's the redhead with the big Merida, like, mane of curly hair. And she plays the White House chef, and she is super fucking great and on fire in this show. Like, it's a stacked cast, but more than just a stack. Oh, Julian McMahon uses his Australian accent.
Oh, nice. Because
he's not having to play that nip-tuck like role.
Yeah.
Like, because he plays the Prime Minister of Australia. And like I said, Kylie Minogue, like, there's this line that Kylie Minogue says, she's at a dinner and she's performing, and at a certain point they're questioning her, and she says something that's probably the funniest thing that you could possibly have her say, because at a certain point you keep on hearing her song over and over again, and you're like, why do they keep playing this goddamn song? And she's like, I played the fucking song 7 goddamn times. It's that kind of like knowing show, but it's treated with the kind of like it's very much Knives Out and Only Murderers in the Building. Like, it has a very understanding sense of itself, but it also understands that the supporting cast is like what makes these shows. And the is way this... that it's set. What?
Is this the first comedy that Shonda Rhimes? Because this is Shonda Rhimes. We haven't talked about that. So yeah. It's one of her because she had that deal with Netflix, started a couple of years ago, right? She's just creating shows for Netflix.
She's been doing the Bridgerton stuff, which has been super successful for her. Like, yeah,
but that's I haven't watched it, but that's not really comedy, is it?
No, it is not. I mean, she doesn't do she doesn't do comedy. This is her first comedy, but she also did it with this other writer. Like, she didn't create it. She produced it, and she's helping showrun it.
Okay.
With her girl, Betsy Beers. These two are like...
Oh, created by Paul William Davies. Let's see. Yes. I don't... doesn't ring a bell. Of Scandal, For the People, Betray. Okay. Yeah. I mean, shows I don't watch, but
yeah,
successful shows.
Exactly.
Yeah. People fucking love Scandal, man.
It's good. Like, it's good. It's very... I don't even know how to explain it. I don't know how to explain...
This is based on a book.
Yes. A book... Okay, so the book, I should tell you, is not what you... It's kind of like, if you read the book is more like The Butler, where it's a behind-the-scenes look at the staff at the White House.
Gotcha.
They use this as contextual for the mystery. So, like, they're not making a... It's a sideways adaptation. Like, they don't use... They use
gotcha.
The data, like, they use the stuff from that to create a mystery show. Gotcha. And... I will tell you, that stuff is just as fascinating, and how they deliver it is kind of great. The comedy is very much like Knives Out, where it's like there's still the humanity and we're still dealing with a murder, but the comedy comes from acidic lines and
it's jokes. Not the broad kind of comedy, it's more the like point, like Only Murders kind of, like, it does the slapsticky broad thing, but it also does that like very pointed, like sarcastic or mean or like just that kind of real world comedy. Correct. But it also does the like, oh, I stepped on a rake and whacked myself in the head thing too. So, and this doesn't feel like that, other than like her being this like eccentric detective. Like, I literally got to the point where they're watching her on the lawn and it cuts back to what's her name, like testifying, and she's like, yeah, it felt, it was only 5 minutes. And then they're still watching her and it cuts back. She goes, it felt a lot longer than that. And I was like, I'm going to stop this right here, because I think I want to, like, I want this to be an Us show. So,
yeah, this is definitely one of those things where we were, as a couple, we were laughing. And we kind of vibed on the show. It's definitely something that you can watch together, like have your dessert, like what we ended up doing was like, we had our dessert from last night and then we started watching it. And then, like I said, like two hours later, we were three episodes in and I'm like, it's fucking midnight. We got a lot to do.
Yeah.
But I mean, like tonight we'll probably end up, like, I would not be surprised if we get close to finishing it or do another four episodes and we get to like, cause there's only eight.
Yeah. I was about to say, it's not as long as Running Point, but the episodes are longer. It's a 45, 50 minute show. As opposed to Running Point, I don't think I had an episode that was longer than 25 minutes, which made it so fucking bingeable. Like, literally, if you run, not to go back to Running, but if you cut the language out of that show and some of the sex stuff, it's a network comedy. Like, it could air on ABC.
I mean, even if you like, so like the only, like the sex stuff, the only thing is that it's the one shower scene where you see that.
Yeah.
And even if you zoomed in, you'd be fine. And you'd take out some of the language, like you said, the language.
Yeah.
And it definitely is a network show.
it's good that Netflix has these. This seems to, going back to this show, it seems to be doing pretty well. Like, even the IMDb reviews are pretty good for it, which is weird because like the because it just premiered this week and everything going into it, like I read a couple of early reviews and they were not good. Like it was like, oh, 5 out of 10, like this is a waste of talent. And then, like I said, I watched the first 5 minutes just to see, like just to get a taste and see if it's something that I would want to watch. And 5 minutes in, I was like, oh no, I think this is going to be a good show. And then like all the non-critic reviews seem to be really mostly positive. So I don't, I find that's fascinating. So it's one thing when they're like all kind of like within, but like critic reviews were like, oh, this is 4 or 5 out of 10. And user reviews are like, oh, this is 7, 8 out of 10. Like, that's a huge gap.
It's a huge difference. And I can see, like, I don't know why. Because as, like this is just popcorn. Like, this is, like, buttery popcorn.
I mean, sometimes, people just don't want to have a good time. But, yeah, Netflix definitely needed some good quality content that was successful, because they spent $350 million on a movie that no one is watching.
Dirt Wars, I know. And then also the other thing is light and positive, because so did I tell you that I watched the first hour, like I watched the first episode of Adolescence, and I literally wanted to throw my fucking remote.
I'm hearing a lot about this show, including fucking Variety writing an article that spoiled some of the finale in the fucking title of the article. I was so pissed off. I was like, are you serious? Like, it's one thing when a bullshit, like, online-only website does this, but a Variety article? Like, don't you know better? But
so with that,
I may or may not watch it. I may or may like
go ahead. It's Euphoria, but with violence rather than sex.
That's what it looked like.
And literally, I watched the first episode, and I'm like, nope, I'm good. I don't need to know. Like, maybe, like, okay, so, like, here's the thing. I feel like this show was created for the dumb fuck parents that don't do anything about their fucking murder child, that don't want to see the fucking signs that your fucking kid is an incel Nazi shit. Like, that's literally who this show is designed for, because it is such a skeevy, creepy ass, like, and I know that that's the point, but it's like this. Like, I don't know if you've watched Euphoria. I've on the sly watched it, and I will tell you, the show feels more like. So, I think I've said this before, like on the show, is that you like Euphoria can't have its cake and eat it too. It can't be exploitive, and teach its lessons. Like, it needs to be a documentary. Like, that's the way that I feel. Like, if you're wanting to do this, you're automatically doing a salacious thing. As soon as you show Sydney Sweeney with her top off and fucking guys, as soon as you show Eric Dane and his dong, and we'll get to another dong thing that's actually funny and not this. Like, if you're showing these things in this way, there's no way that this cannot be salacious, that it can't be exploitative. And the thing is with this show is I'm like, who the fuck is this show for? Like, it's like it's about, like, you know, like, you can go up and look at what this show is, but it's essentially murder by way of Euphoria. Like, the kids aren't all right, and these fucking dumb fuck parents can't see what is very obvious, would be very obvious to anybody, like, with the actions of what they're doing, because there's so much, like, copacetic empathy with fucking parents and these parents that don't want to do anything. And it's like the Stephen Graham performance, the guy who plays the father, fuck, like, he's on a roll. Like, but I mean, Stephen Graham hit, like, since I first saw him on Gangs of New York, where he's like, you know, in the background, he's an interesting character. Or actually, no, it was he actually played the co-lead in Snatch. He played Jason Statham's brother, partner. And since then, I've always loved him, and he's kind of gotten this thing, this elevation since, like, you know, since working with Scorsese. But, like, I asked myself, what for? Like, maybe be a better parent, and maybe this will help parents, but I don't know, man. Like, I just was like, I watched it, like, the first episode, and I was like, nope, not for me. This is definitely, there's too much bullshit and flaming trash going on in the world. I don't need this in my life. But it's huge. It, like, it has, like, what? Like, it made 25 million viewers in 5 days? That's huge for Netflix.
Yeah.
It's just so dour and so violent and so dark and so kind of, I don't want to say exploitive, but it feels exploitative to me.
I think we both are in a, the real world sucks so bad, and I don't want to, like, I don't want that in my entertainment right now.
Yeah.
Like, I think we're both in that kind of era, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's easy to fall down a rabbit hole of, like, Bojack Horseman was a show that I watched on repeat pretty religiously. I did watch half of an episode today while I was eating breakfast, but, like, I couldn't tell you since November of last year. I don't think I've revisited that show at all, which is weird, because usually I would watch a handful of episodes, like, every week. And it's because it's so dark that I'm just like,
yeah.
When I do, like, I watched half of it, the first episode this morning, eating breakfast, and I was like, yeah, I don't know if I need this right now.
Yeah, it's like one of those things where I can handle it sometimes. Like, so, like, there's this other thing that I watched recently, It's called Borderline. It's a movie with Samara Weaving and Ray Nicholson. And yes, he is a Nepo baby. And I'm like, but it's fabulous. And it's a very dark, dark, violent comedy. It's about, like, Samara Weaving plays this pop star in the 90s. And she's modeled after the 90s pop stars, not the Britney ones, but like Madonna, where she's got a huge career in pop, but she's also an actress. And like, she actually, like, the reason why I say Madonna is because like her big like movie is a movie where she plays a female baseball player. But then the one thing that like superstars like that have that nobody wants is a stalker, and it's played by Ray Nicholson. Nicholson as in Jack. And it's how this man comes into her life. And I don't want to ruin the plot because I feel like everybody should see this movie. This is a debut by this guy named Jimmy Ward. It was produced by Brian Duffield. I mean, we've talked about Duffield, but also by Margot Robbie. And if you know Duffield, you know that he deals with tricky tones, and this is very a tricky tone movie where it's funny, but it's also very violent, like extremely violent, like horror style violent. And the way that it balances that tone, like, I've seen it twice. I'm going to show it to my wife probably this weekend, because it is so fascinating to watch how this thing balances tone, which I'm going to tell you, adolescence does not. Like, and I'm not saying that they're the same thing, but I feel like tone is a big thing for me now. And if you're going to do something wild, you better be able to land it and not end up on one side or the other. And that's why I say documentary. When I talk about like these kinds of things, like incel violence and stuff, give me a documentary about it. I'll watch that, because at least it's not being salacious, because they kind of can't be salacious with those things. They can have the people talk about it, but it's the victims that are talking about it. It's not like a one-sided affair, which adolescence felt very much a one-sided affair of like watching this little shit fucking, like this little shit, like serial killer in training. But Borderline does like this weird funny thing where it's like, it shows both points of view, but like Duffield's, like the best of Duffield's work, he manages to like the guy who he worked with that produced, like that directed it and wrote the script. There's this very tricky way that they actually are able to do the tone right, where the violence feels like violence and the comedy feels like comedy, and they're informing on one another. Borderline, that's what it's called. I definitely recommend that one. And Ray Nicholson looks kind of like his dad, but not his dad. But like, this is one of those things where, this is one of those movies where after I watched it, I was like, this fucking kid, like, I don't care if he's a Nepo baby, this fucking kid can act with a capital A. Like, yeah, damn. So there was that too, Borderline. Logan, you're muted.
Oh, sorry. I didn't even know I hit the mute button. I think the only other things I was going to bring up that you didn't watch is the finales of Harley Quinn and Invincible, and only to say that like they both really stick the fucking landing.
Oh, good.
Harley Quinn, like I'm assuming they're getting another season, but it is very much a, if this is the end, this is the end. Invincible, we know they're getting another season. Not only is Invincible coming back, they're saying it will be back probably late next year, but definitely next year. Or mid to late next year, they're going to do a storyline completely original to the show that is not adapted from any of the comics.
Oh,
which is really fucking interesting.
That really is. Like, I like that idea. I really do like that idea. I'm actually almost done with last season, and I'm starting this season for both shows. So like I went back and watched Harley Quinn, and you're right. Like I will say, the last season for Harley Quinn,
It was middling. Like the whole setting them against each other really didn't work for me. Like their relationship became such a foundation for the show that having them on opposite sides, I think it really, really hurt the show. So much so that like they had to, it was almost like a reboot this season where it's like, oh, we're taking them out of Gotham. We're moving them to Metropolis and we're going to introduce like a whole new subset of side characters, including Lena Luthor and Superman, who gets some really, really good stuff. Lois Lane and Brainiac. And, you know, you do get those characters from like season one and two coming in every now and then. But not this current season, but season before, really did, I think, a disservice to the show. Invincible almost the same way, but only because they fucked it up by, oh, like you're getting 8 episodes, here's 4, and now wait 4 months and here's 4 more, as opposed to just giving it all at once. It really shot themselves in the foot. This is not necessarily a spoiler for the show. But there's a character that shows up at the end of this season of Invincible, voiced by Jeffrey Dean Morgan. And I saw the funniest fucking, he's a Viltrumite. He shows up to beat the shit out of Mark. That's not really a spoiler. But I saw somebody posted or tweeted, whatever, I don't remember where it was. It said, if I had a nickel for every time Jeffrey Dean Morgan played a character who showed up to beat the ever-loving shit
out of Steven Yeun,
I would only have 2 nickels, out of Steve Yeun, and a property created by Robert Kirkman. I would only have 2 nickels, but I'm just saying it's weird that it's happened twice. Jeffrey Dean Morgan thing is definitely stunt casting on their part of like, hey, we have this character who's going to show up late in the season, and literally his only job is to beat the ever-loving shit out of this character. Who should we get to voice it? Oh, Jeffrey Dean Morgan, of course, because it's funny in a dark way that it's him doing it to him again. Like, yeah. it's pretty weird. But Invincible this season is fucking incredible. There is an emotional beat in the second to last episode or third to last episode. It's in the last 3 episodes that we've kind of thought was coming before now, but when it happens, it is fucking devastating. It's so just like, fuck, I can't believe they're going to do this. It's perfect. Like, I cannot believe if for how shit season 2 felt because of what they did, I cannot believe how well they pulled off season 3. It's fucking incredible.
I can't wait to watch it again. Report back as soon as I do.
All right. So you want to talk about Gemstones for a few minutes?
Sure. Did you? Frank?
I lost you for a second. What?
I said before we do that, did you want to talk Frank and Born Again, or did you want to do?
We can talk Daredevil real quick. I the only thing I have to say about Daredevil is the Frank Castle of it all.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, I figure that that's the thing that we kind of want to talk about, and it being a quick discussion.
Nobody's ever going to be as good as he is at playing Frank Castle.
Not at all. Like, the way he says fanboys is so derogatory. It feels like it feels like a curse word to like pawn off like the police with the tattoos. And to be honest, it feels like he's doing it to everybody that's like a fanboy of like of the Punisher, not just in the show but outside. It's a very meta moment, but he says it with such just kind of like, it's exactly the way that you think Frank would react about that. Like about like, it's not even like he wants to have a discussion about it. I do love that it's Frank that sets him straight, but not straight. Like, do we think that he's like, okay, let me ask you, do you think that Frank's words get to Matt, not to Daredevil, but to Matt?
Oh, for and sure.
Does he
for
get
sure.
the wrong message? Does he take the wrong message from it?
I mean, Matt's so hard headed that, I mean, I think it steals him for what he's already doing, as opposed to pushing back towards maybe at least what we feel he should be doing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. Like, it's really something to watch. Like, this, for how I felt at the end of the first episode, and even the second episode, the last two episodes have been so fucking good and have not involved a single bit of Daredevil. Just Matt Murdock. I don't know, man. I am amazed at what they've been able to do as far as like even reversing course in their own fucking show, and just making it their own. And the slow roll to bring him back as the Punisher, I was worried it wasn't going to be worth it, and it absolutely was. And
it's so perfect.
Bringing him in as even more unhinged than he already was is the right call. And yeah, I don't know. It was fucking perfect television, even though I feel like not really anything happened.
Yeah. Well, nothing action-wise happens, but...
Oh, and the thing with the Kingpin. Oh, my God. With the fucking, we built this city on rock and roll. That was so funny, man.
Well, okay, so, like, I have a couple of questions before we leave. First, Frank's back, right? Like Matt and him... Like, what I liked about the show that I felt like we only got in the first Punisher... influence season of Daredevil is that they push each other in a way that isn't good for one another. Right. It's so codependent, but it forces them into action. So is this confrontation? Because like it hits hard when you see Charlie Cox is the actor, but when you see Matt and his inability to stay foggy, but then when he says foggy, he breaks. Is that the moment that both of them know that they need to get back out there? Or is it the moment that it's not enough for it steals up Matt to not do anything? Because at the end we get the whole like he's fighting and stuff, like he's doing the work with his stuff, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's going to go back into action. I don't know. Like, but also does it mean that Frank knows that he needs to be out there and not.
I really think Matt showing up and tracking him down, and like Frank was trying to like, that's probably why he's so much more unhinged, trying to stay low and keep his head more or less in the sand. And yeah. Matt showing up and being like, hey, like this happened, like your logo, they're carrying it around. Like it, basically Frank's resolve now is like, well, I gotta do something about this, and we might be about to see like War on the Cops in a Disney Plus Daredevil show, which is really fucking interesting.
No, it very much so is. And we have, and this is the reason why I ask, is because we have a 2-episode drop this week.
Yep.
Episode 5 and 6 are dropping this week. And so my thing is that I almost think that they knew that whatever the cliffhanger is in episode 5, it doesn't work. Like, it needs to be the
full event. Yeah, it's got to be. Yeah. And yeah, it doesn't feel like a burn-off, like the way, weirdly enough, Spider-Man cartoon felt like they were just burning episodes, even though they picked it up for 3 seasons. It does feel more like a, oh shit, this doesn't work. It works better together than it does splitting it up. So, and also maybe there's something there that's like, because the show isn't doing boffo numbers for them. It's doing okay, but not great. So like, maybe they're like, we need this big pop. So whatever it is, like, it might be huge, but yeah, like this past episode for an episode where very little happens to like further the action stuff. Like, it was a fucking great episode of television.
It really was. Like, they, like, what I like in the Feige era of Daredevil Born Again is that it's a drama. Before, it's a drama with tinges of action, but not really. They're trying to really set the emotional table, and I appreciate that. As an adult that, like, knows the heights that Daredevil can go to, right? Like, we both know how good of a just drama it can be when it's in the right hands of the right writer and the right the right artists. It's very interesting to watch this show play out. It's still in a, like you said, like, I still get that tinge and that bouncing in my head of like, man, I'd really like the swashbuckling version of Matt, like, give Matt a break. But we've already hit into this, like, you know, this is already in, like, we're already invested. And to be quite honest, if you're going to write it this way, fuck. I mean, we didn't even talk about Blake and what happened with Blake. I mean, that is a fucking, like, talk about taking a character that's kind of like a weird sycophantic joke.
Yeah.
Weaponizing him, because he will do anything now for the Kingpin, and he probably will. And it's going to be scary. But I love the fuck it. That's so good. That's such great writing. It's like we just were talking about with another show, which is that you don't leave your supporting characters to hang. You give them that kind of moment. And weaponizing him, weaponizing Blake, and also weaponizing his chief of staff. Like, that's like some wild shit. I really like it. And also just like you said, the built your city on rock and roll is so hilarious. And in that moment,
it was so fucking funny when he shows up to that press conference and I forget which country it is, but they're fucking singing it too. It's like, oh my God.
Dr. Doom's home country, Latvia, remember?
Yeah, that's right.
That's something that else that they've kind of started to like lay the seeds for, which I was genuinely surprised by. I was like, oh, you're going to start laying that seed. That's cool. Okay. I see where this is going to go.
I doubt it goes anywhere, but yeah.
No, but it's just laying the seed. It's like, okay, we're going to start throwing this name out there. It's just like the Miss Marvel and Mutants kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You just kind of lay the seed out there, and yeah. To be perfectly honest, like at this point now, I kind of would have liked to see a $100 million gritty R-rated Daredevil Punisher movie.
I'd be in for that. I mean, I doubt they do it, but I'd be in.
Oh yeah. Like, just tell me one contained story. Let Benson and Moorhead like have their movie time, and like get them out of TV and onto movies. But I mean, I'm okay with it right now. Like at this point, it's like I've never been excited for the Daredevil Netflix version. I am excited week to week to see what happens in this show.
I'm with you. So it was Daredevil on Netflix was just, you just binged it, so it's hard to be gonna be excited week to week because you're like, oh, I just watched it all.
Exactly. It's like, oh, 12 hours.
So you want to talk about Walton Goggins' penis?
Yeah, seriously. What we all thought was going to happen on fucking White Lotus, Danny McBride and everybody were like, hold my beer and let's get baby Billy Bonkers Bonker on screen. Jesus Christ, dude. Like,
and not just like for like 20 seconds. Like, there's a whole, like, 2-minute scene where it just keeps cutting him completely naked.
Like, fucking Frankenbeans, like they said in fucking Something About Mary.
Yeah.
Goddamn Frankenbeans, man. Like, hats off to Walton Goggins, man, showing his Goggins.
I mean, he had a hell of a week. Like, I'm still bored out of my mind with White Lotus, but, like, he's showing up, like he's doing the work there.
His name come up? Dancing Man? Leslie yeah. Bibb. Mr. Yeah. Leslie Bibb. What's his name? Won the Academy Award. I love him too. Justin Hammer, but I can't think of his name.
Yeah, he gets a really, really good speech in last week's episode that goes fucking wild places. I don't have these guys ever been in a movie or a show together, because holy shit, like them, they worked so well together. But and also, Walton Goggins, I just talked about Invincible, he's a key part of that show too. So, yeah, what a hell of a week he was having. But yeah, capped off by Righteous Gemstones, just. Fucking so crazy, man. Just
right, like just wacky. Like, I forget, like, so like I told you, I texted you, I was like, I could not stop laughing for the first 5 minutes, because I like prologue made us all fucked up and kind of made us like forget that this show can be stupid, but stupid in the best way possible. Like they're on those jetpacks, and when Jesse like jetpack fails and it starts doing the Homer,
yeah,
I lost my shit. I literally had to start the fucking episode over again after that, because after that you see baby Billy's dick. Yeah. Like, he literally takes off his clothes and you're like, and I could not, like, I lost all like reason and accountability, as they say. I just could not stop laughing because it's just so ridiculous.
So what do you think about them bringing Megan Mullally like into it?
Oh man.
As a new romantic interest?
Or Eli. Dr. Yeah. Eli. So I feel like it's going, like, this is something that I feel is going to rip, like it could rip them apart at a certain point in the show, because of the way that the kids interact with her at the beginning. Like, this is no good. Like, I feel like this is going to be, like, we are going to get an Eli flashback, and we are going to get some shit that I feel like nobody wants to know because of the way that they acted. I feel like they probably had a relationship. And it was cut short because for whatever reason he got was it Judy? No, it's not Judy. You never think of her name. The mother got her pregnant. And like, the kids love her, but they hold their mother in such high regard. Yeah. And they turn into children. Like, I found it funny, but then on my second watch, I was like, you can see the seeds that they're sowing, and the kids revert back to literally childhood when they're around her. Like, she is like this golden, like she's like this golden parachute for them. And what happens when they find out that their dad is pumping uglies with her? Because they are, like, the thing that I love the most is like slow clap for fucking Danny McBride, Jody Hill and company for giving John Goodman a love interest. Like,
yeah.
Like, but also like, Am I wrong in saying that there was, like, the instant you see them together?
Oh, yeah, you know. Like, there's something there.
And there's chemistry that's there between the two. Like, I mean, it doesn't shock me. Megan Mullally has been, like, you know, been married to the chunky bearded dude of all bearded dudes forever and a day. So, like, I can make the, like, it makes sense to me that she would be the person that you would cast as, like, John Goodman's love interest. And this is something I've been waiting 30 years for, is John Goodman to be in, like, some kind of romantic comedy or romantic entanglement in a show that isn't star Roseanne Barr.
Yeah.
And she's so fucking good. Like, she is, like, in that small moment, that whole, is it just me, or is she channeling a Tammy Wynette / Dolly? Oh,
absolutely.
And just the way that fucking Goodman looks at her, like, there's just, like, there's lust in his eyes. It's great. Like, like, my favorite part is the kissing, the slow motion kissing where she stops him, and you go, "Oh no, this was a mistake." Oh, okay, we're back on point. Yeah. What did you think of it? Like, what did you think of that story? Like, that kind of...
I'm excited for that. So I don't know where they're going with the story with the kids. Like, if it's just going to be them reacting to this. But I love what they're doing with Eli. Baby Billy is always just, like, the...
Baby Billy.
He's not even the salad dressing. Like, because nobody wants to eat a dry salad. It's more like... You can have salad without croutons, but it's really not as good. Like, he's the croutons of the show.
I was gonna say he's the chocolate syrup on ice cream.
Yeah. Where it's like you can have the ice cream without it, but, like, you add it and it's just like, oh yeah, this is actually a little bit better.
But I'll go a step further and say Baby Billy is not chocolate syrup, but not, like, he's the chili onion crunch. You know, like, that whole thing that they talk about how, like, chili onion crunch on vanilla is, like, really good. And it is. That's how fucking weird he is that you try to explain, like, I was trying to explain to my wife, because she had, like, you know, she's like, she finally got to the Baby Billy episode in, I think it's, like, what is it, like, halfway through season two or season one, where he shows up, and she's like, who the fuck, why is Walton
with the fucking almost here? Child bride.
Yeah, and I'm like, I'm sorry, just go with it. He is the extra.
It's like, this doesn't, like, it's already a show that's a little bit too much most of the time, and it's like, this is too much on too much, but, like, somehow it's what makes it work better than anything.
Yes.
So
well, and now she gets my, like, she goes, and I thought that your dad, because my dad is Christian, he's born again, and I'm not ashamed of it or anything. He goes to church every Sunday. I do not. I'm a godless heathen. I'm not godless and just heathen. But my dad is, okay, I say this because you'll get the context once I say it. My dad is born again, and I have a baby blue Baby Billy Bible Bonkers t-shirt I wear around all the time. And my wife never said anything and thought it was, like, so she got to the Baby Billy and she goes, holy shit, your fucking t-shirt is not from your dad. It's from this fucking TV show.
That's funny.
And I couldn't help but fucking lose my shit. Like, because she hasn't gotten to Baby Billy's
Bible Bonkers.
Which is a huge fucking hit now. What did he call himself? What does he say? What does he say about himself when he says he has to go to the show because he's the superstar of the of the whole fucking thing, and then the Bible. So but she did not get that, and now she gets it, and she goes, I can't even, like, you're not allowed to wear that fucking shirt anymore. And I'm like, fuck, I'm not. The deuce you say, I'm gonna fucking wear it because Baby Billy Bible Bonkers. Come on now.
He's just so good. I there's so many aspects of his storyline that we haven't come full circle on.
No.
that's he's one I'm like, man, I hope, I know this is it for the show. I hope it doesn't do a disservice by like not giving us all that, but I also know that the focus is more on the like the Gemstone family proper. So that mm-hmm. stuff that could fall by the wayside. Although I think they're all great and they're all like knocking it out of the park, even when I'm like, God, Judy annoys the shit out of me. But
Judy and BJ.
Yeah. The BJ pole dancing thing was really funny though. But the trailer did spoil that. So
yeah.
But it was like it went on forever, man. So
it really was like a little bit too far, but then that's Big Bride. Hill and
I mean that's what they do, they go just a little too far, and when they think is this too far, they go, well, let's take it a little bit further. I'm blown away by just what every time they do something off the wall, I'm just like, oh my God, man.
Tom Hanks as himself
yeah. Like just a fucking 2 minute like Abbott and Costello routine about what the name of the Tom Hanks movie is.
Yeah, the Tom Hanks by himself. It's the by himself. Oh my God. Like, I watched that 4 times because it just made me fucking giggle. Like, Danny McBride, like, there's going to be a point where I know Danny McBride's going to stop acting and he'll just do directing and writing. Like,
yeah.
It's sowed in the seeds of everything. Like, the prelude, basically, like, the writing is in the wall. Like, if he quit after A Righteous Gemstones, he has every right to and just be a writer director, like every right to, because he could like, I mean, what, he's shown like
what sucks is that what's his name, the one's friends with him and Seth Rogen, they got himself canceled,
James Franco.
Yeah. James Franco was also really good at doing that too.
Yeah.
And fucked it all up with his, like, I want to start a quote acting class and then just use it to hit on fucking 18-year-old girls. But yeah, like Franco has a few like directorial efforts out there that like didn't get big wide release that are really fucking good, like dramas, not like,
yes,
and they're just really fucking good, very well made, and you know, McBride can do that too.
He can. He did this post-apocalyptic movie that, like, I saw right before he got canceled, and I didn't write about it because I was like, oh man, this is just too tricky. It's like trying to write about fucking Woody Allen, right? Like, you're just like, no, that's a bridge too far. And it's really good. But I mean, like, thankfully, Danny McBride has not been canceled. He seems to be a pretty, like, everything that I've read and heard about him, he's a pretty upstanding guy, has family. Like, Jesse is kind of based off of, like, from everything that I understood, like, he said that Jesse is as close to him as possible at his most, like, whenever he's having arguments with his wife, like, it's something that, like, at his most arched is Jesse's baseline. Like, yeah. Whenever he's getting into arguments with, like, his kids and his, like, his wife and, or his dad and his family, like, the highest he goes is Jesse's baseline. Which I find hilarious, and that's, like, actually pretty fucking funny. And that makes pretty much kind of, like, absolute sense that you would be a comic and you would be a guy like that. Like, something I didn't know, did you know that his mom used to create and was a part of, like, Bible puppetry?
Huh.
Yeah.
No, like, I didn't know that.
She created the puppets. She wrote like these like sketches that were a part of her mega church and stuff. And like, you know, like a lot of that informed on his, like some of the stuff that they do in Gemstones. So yeah, no, absolutely. It's kind of interesting. So I do have to ask about like, so it's like the most interesting thing. And I'm also really wondering how people are going to react to it. Is the Keith and Kelvin storyline.
Yeah, they didn't dive heavy into it other than like just saying like, oh yeah, he's gay and they're together. So like it, I'm honestly surprised. I think it just shows that not enough people watch the show, that there wasn't this like immediate Monday morning like backlash of like, oh God, like this show is like straight up introducing like homosexuality into mainstream Christianity. And, you know, considering the current climate, like the fact that there wasn't some giant headline in that regard, you know, unfortunately, I think does just speak to nobody's watching the show.
To which I'm okay with, because like, okay, so like of the like the weirdest and most progressive part about the show is that because they have a whole church. They have a whole church.
Yeah.
Like that's progressive LGBTQ that they're running that's super successful. Which like it's speak like to me that is like the best part about the show is that like Heath and Kelvin have found their stride, right? Like for the people that were so kind of like what I love about the character arc here, and what worries me, it's going to break my heart when it starts turning on them, because you know that that's kind of probably what is that Kelvin and Keith have found happiness for the first time in both of their lives. Like we've watched them over three seasons, like which like always plays out so weird because it's this weird fantasy bar, like Conan the Barbarian, but very LGBTQ gay. Like, especially like when they, like, I still think it's one of my favorite things is when the group of like the bromosexuals take over the house and they start running their own like fight club cultish Christianity sect. Right. And then it's Keith that helps Kelvin survive that shit. But it's like they finally found their stuff, and it's like my worry is and like, you know, we already know because that's the way the gemstones work, it's gonna come crashing horribly down on them. But also like the prayer pods and Jesse and Jesse's sons, like so I'm gonna throw something at you because it's the kind of bold storytelling I feel like that that these guys do. Do we think that Jesse could die
at
a certain point in the show?
Yeah, like, for sure.
Like not the end, but like literally, like it feels like they're setting up the kids for the next generation. Specifically, what's his name's Skylar, whatever his last name is, his character.
His character, yeah.
I can't even think of his
because it will be kind of like a full circle moment, because we start the show with him basically being like, fuck you, I'm leaving, I'm gonna go be a stunt man in Hollywood, and coming full circle to him now like getting into preaching.
And like, I mean, he's already started it and stuff, right? And then the whole thing of like Jesse being super jealous of his dad because he has the mentorship like my favorite part is that who the fuck is Jesse mentoring? Like he could never mentor anybody. That guy doesn't know like Eli is so like is such the good, like he's like exactly what you would like, he is the realistic version of the best possible preacher you could possibly have, right? Say that because he's both good and bad. It's not like he's like some pious guy.
Kind of always trying to be good, and everything just kind of got away from him. So yeah, it's I'm with you. It would be interesting to see Jesse, like if they kill off Jesse and watching all of that kind of come around and the family maybe kind of just fall apart, like lose everything. Like it would be pretty interesting. So,
or like the other way around could be is that Jesse dies and it's Gideon that brings everybody together.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean? Like Because like let's be honest, Jesse is the worst. Like, we love him because he's so imperfect.
Judy might be worse than, but Judy doesn't have the like leadership thing that he has. No, like, she tries to take it, but like nobody trusts her at all. So like, it's not like the church would fall to her or to Kelvin, but Jesse is pretty bad.
She's like you said, the only thing he has is leadership, but let's be honest, his leadership is bullying. Like, that's literally what he does. It's just, but I mean, that's like the Danny McBride thing, right? It's this overconfidence that hides the lack of any kind of sort of confidence. That's exactly what Jesse is, right? But at the same time, like, I'm interested to see where these story plots go. And like, I was talking to somebody about it that actually watches it too, and I was like, man, they're setting up for like some downfall here, because it's like, we start off like every season starts like this, and by mid season it becomes like this nightmare for everybody. And some stuff you find funny, and sometimes like you're cringe and you stand up and you walk away from the fucking TV because it's so cringe.
Yeah, the profiting off of the death of their mother is so fucking horrific. And the it's just so, but it's like such a, like, that's what happens. Like, it's also true, but it kind of reframes a lot of this memorial shit that you see. And it's just like, somebody's making a profit off of this. Off of the grief and misery, and it's just, I don't know, it's so fucking sad, but like, they play it for laughs, and it's the thing this show does better than maybe any other show. Like, it's so difficult to do stuff like this in live action. BoJack is a good animated example of like a very specific character. You're like, fuck this dude. But even him has, like, you kind of get into the trauma of it all that created him. And we kind of get that with the Gemstones, but like, at some point it's just like, these are just rich assholes, man. Like, the kids specifically. So,
absolutely. Because they don't look at the, like, even Keith and Kelvin, maybe Keith less, but Kelvin, I mean, he's doing it to make money. He's not doing it because these people need a space. He's doing it
literally profiting off of his own sexuality within the church. And it's like so fucking weird and cringe, but also funny. And like the whole like reading parts of the Bible and being like, yeah, but we don't need all of that. So here's my Bible.
Buy my Bible. Like, which
that doesn't like, have all the parts that you want to ignore in it,
which is so fucking brilliant. Like every moment in this show, like, that's why I watch it twice. I've gotten into this habit of watching it twice, watching it the day it premieres, and like watching it Monday morning or like Monday afternoon, and then waiting a couple of days and then watching it on Thursday, because it plays so much different. Like, at first I'm laughing at it, and then the second time I watch it, it is such a weird kind of take of capitalism within the church state. Like, because that's all it is. Like, you can watch it and go, holy shit, how are they getting away with this? And it's because most people don't watch a show two times, and if you do, it's so far away from it.
And like I said, there's so many people who aren't watching this show at all. And I think anybody that it would out and out offend, because, you know, they don't want to admit that, like, so much of this shit does go on.
Mm-hmm.
If they did try to give it a chance, they were out after fucking 5 minutes. So, which is kind of a shame, because, you know, some people, like, it really, like, you really do need to confront this. But, you know, in a more serious, like, we saw this in the, what, like, 80s and 90s with the Catholic Church, and so many people just being like, that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And,
I mean,
you know,
even even it, Tammy Faye Baker and Jim Baker, like, like there's so much corruption within the church things.
And people just want to turn a blind eye to it. And it's just so disheartening. But like, for this show to like continually shine a light on that, but also still be funny. I don't know. It's such a, we've talked about it so much, but it's such a weird line to walk, man. And somehow they do it and they keep getting people to come on board and like play. The fact that John Goodman is in this show is fucking astounding. Like he's in, we've talked about it, but like he's in a totally different show. But it's within the craziness of this show. It's so fucking weird, man. Like he's done some very strange things. Like he's had a very like just wild career anyway. And it's, you know, kind of just down to do whatever. But like this is something I would never think he would, just because it's so fucking bizarre most of the time. Not because he was offended by it, but just because it's like, who is this for?
And you know what?
It's for like 100 people.
Yeah, literally. Like I don't know who it's for, but it's for me. Like,
right. Yeah.
Like, and that's the thing that I love so much about it is that it speaks to me, and in a way that I don't think other shows do, because like, I'm somebody who's accepting of anybody's like religious beliefs, even if it's corrupted religious beliefs, that's your beliefs. Like you're allowed, every human being is allowed their own fucking piece of the world. I mean, right. my problem becomes is when you try to encroach on everybody else.
Yeah. I was about to say, you don't live too far from the home of the fucking, one of the biggest religious scams of the last, you know, not saying Christianity isn't, but of the last 100 years started like in his house, not too far from where you are, you know?
No, that is true. But I always say like, okay, so like, here's the thing is that like, everybody is allowed their own piece of whatever.
You have the Jason Lees that are Scientologists, and then you have the Tom Cruise Scientologist, you know?
Exactly. You know,
and we are Cruise fans, but it's still like he's definitely in that like weird, corrupt, like inner circle of all of it. Whereas like Jason Lee's also a Scientologist, but it feels very much like how I might say I'm Christian. You know, where it's like, oh, okay, yeah, okay, well, but you don't like every interview or like you're not beating people over the head with it. So, you know, it's real, real weird. But yeah, this show walks that line so freaking well. I can't wait. Like, it sounds weird. I don't want to rush through the final season, but I do think that they're wrapping it up because they have something else they want to do.
Yeah, that's what like that's the thing. That's the final thing that I'm going to like I was going to ask you about, which is that it feels like there's another two like after watching this, this feels like there's another two seasons that could go out and we could still have a like six seasons.
This is longer than anything that they've done collectively ever.
Yes. But doesn't it feel like it's a little rushed? Like this season, now that I'm like two episodes in, I'm like, and you have a prelude in it.
The prelude is what throws me. Like, where does that go? Like, is it just this like, oh, we had this idea and we got everybody on board and we shot it and it kind of sort of ties in, or does this really, really go? Like, is somebody going to find out that the Gemstone family starts with this event and like this corruption, this murder, this like fighting for the South? Like, is that going to be the downfall of the Gemstones, or is it just a throwaway story?
So, like, the big thing for me is Interlude 4. So, like, the way that they construct these seasons is that they have an interlude where it flashes back to the Gemstones, and the last one was Y2K, right? Like the whole Y2K, and that informed on everything, that informed on the entire season last season because of the kind of way that the Doomsday things that they were selling stuff, and they were hooking stuff, and then and that's also the one that what's her name does not like. Isn't that the one where she dies, where Amy Lee dies finally?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
And so, Interlude 4 is going to be set after Amy Lee died, and I have a feeling that everything has to do with, like, kind of like we're gonna talk about that. But I also think that the prelude also has to do something with it too. And like you said, like violence, like this was a family that found their calling that was begat of violence, conning, and cowardice. I mean, that's literally what happens in what we see in Prelude is Elijah Gemstone is a murderer, a crook, and a coward. And the reason why he is these things is because he's trying to run away from everything. He's trying to make a simple buck. And then by some act of God, he manages to get away. But he, like, I love that Bradley Cooper plays that role, because when I rewatched it, something that we didn't talk about, which is this, is that the look he gives at the end of that show is not one that he learned his way, is that he learned a new color. And I feel like the Gemstones, if we go back and we watch the first three seasons, it's not like the Gemstones, like, they're just like Elijah. They didn't learn a lesson. They just learned a new con.
Yeah.
Or they learned that they could get away with things. And does this season ultimately end with the chickens coming home to roost?
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see where they take it. All right, so let's talk about the Looney Tunes for a few minutes.
Yeah.
Very briefly, like, so Ketchup Entertainment or whatever they're called, I don't even know who the fuck these people are, but have come out of nowhere to possibly seemingly rescue something that Warner Brothers, a property that Warner Brothers hasn't known what to do with for decades. I mean, they don't even know what to do with their fucking superhero property up until maybe now. But they haven't known what to do with the Looney Tunes franchise. I mean, in our lifetime, maybe the most successful thing was Space Jam.
Yeah. I mean, they literally took as an example, they took the one person that understands Looney Tunes through and through, Joe Dante. They took his movie and they changed it completely when he made a Looney Tunes live action movie. Like, that movie that we have, Looney Tunes Back in Action, is not the movie he made.
Yeah.
It was literally
terrible, but yeah, what they did was fucking inexcusable. And it was because they don't, like you said, Dante understands stuff like that. They didn't understand, like, what makes those characters special. You'll know better than me. These guys, they didn't produce this movie. It only, like, they bought it, essentially, like, bought it off of Warner Brothers to distribute it.
The Day the Earth Blew Up was actually developed by HBO Max. It started being developed sometime in 2022. Like, it started to be produced. Like, they started, like, to actively create this movie, right?
Which means it would have also been buried. like either buried or just written off. Like, I don't know how this is the one, like, briefly, like, I enjoyed the movie. I think it's really funny. It's this weird fucking love letter to paranoid sci-fi movies from, like, literally the 50s through the 80s. Like, referencing, like, John Carpenter's Thing and They Live.
The Day the Earth Stood Still. What's the Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah. Like, so many of those, like, Creature and it's fucking wild how many references they got in there that for in a kids movie. And it's also this weird kind of love letter to like the 90s animation, like offbeat stuff that never, like, I guess it did, like Ren and Stimpy was mainstream popular, but never on the level of something like The Simpsons, right?
No. Right, yeah.
Because, like, the opening scene with Farmer Jim or whatever, is, like, just
it's very
reeks of Ren and Stimpy.
Yeah.
Just, it's, I was like, this is so fucking bizarre. So bizarre. Like, the still animation, if you watch Ren and Stimpy, you'll know what I mean.
You know, exactly, yeah.
And then the, like, walking away, but, like, he wasn't even moving his feet. And then, like, he just walks into the sunset and disappears and becomes God somehow. Like, it's so fucking weird.
It's so weird, but it's, like, so, like, as a 90s kid, it resonates. Because you know the like, it's, like, this weird language shorthand and just weird fuckery. But at the end of the day, it's, like, it's this weird thing of, like, you completely understand exactly what they're doing in the short story, the shorthand storytelling that they're using, and why they can't just say, like, they could say that Farmer Jim dies, but they're doing it in the way that, like, the 90s used to, like, make fun of the way that the 50s used to do it in animation. But it fucking works. Like,
it's a Russian nesting doll of a film. Where like, it works on surface level just as a funny offbeat animated film. But then, like, if you're a cinephile or if you're into, like, big time animation, that, like, there's some stuff in this movie that looks like it was drawn by the same people that did Aeon Flux. It's so weird, like, just certain panels, not whole sequences, just panels where it's like, that looks like it was lifted from Aeon Flux.
it really does. Like, it's
the eyeball stuff, you know, like, was really fucking fascinated with close-ups of people's eyeballs.
Like that, and then, like, the way that they got away with the thing, like gum.
Yeah.
Like, and what it turns into. Like, you're just, like, watching it, you're going, and then the flamethrowers, and you're just like, who the fuck? Like, who decided
is wild. It's just wild that it exists. And that's why I said it's weird to me that this was the one that wasn't immediately, like, the Coyote versus Acme, it's a mix of live action and animated. I know it probably cost a little bit more, so that's why they wanted to write it off. But this is the one where I can't believe it does feel like an HBO Max thing. I can't believe it got a theatrical release, and that's all thanks to the Ketchup people. But I can, as if I were running a studio and it was like, oh, we did two Looney Tunes movies. I haven't seen Coyote versus Acme, but I can very much see, like, sitting down and being like, I don't know who this one is for because it is so off the wall. But, like, I get the, like, live action mix thing. And sorry, Ripley's going nuts for some reason. Like, I don't know how this wasn't the one that you write off because it's so bonkers.
Okay, so it really is, but also like at $15 million, it's a non-factor, especially.
Right. That's the thing, right? It didn't cost as much money. And that's why it didn't get written off.
To me, $15 million for this fucking movie is wild. Like, this is a movie that I feel is just as beautiful, just as inventive as anything in Moana 2. Like, anything in Moana 2.
I still haven't seen Moana 2. I still haven't seen Moana 2.
Check. Go see it. Chee-hoo! But, I mean, I will tell you that, like, the movie isn't as creative, like, anywhere near as creative as The Day the Earth Blew Up. And it costs, like I said, 20 times less than, or maybe not 20, maybe, like, let's say 15 times less. Like, it's Moana 2 is a $250 million movie. Like I said, like, this one only costs $15 million. But I will tell you, it is beautiful. It is not half-assed draw. Like, yes, there are some shortcuts like the farm, like the Farmer Jim stuff.
But it's on purpose. Like, it's not badly drawn. It's intentionally, like, under animated, because it's beautifully drawn. It's just under animated.
No, exactly. And, like, for me, the whole thing is that I watch this and I go, this is, like, it's beautiful. It's shot widescreen. It does things that I don't think that any Disney movie would do. Like, any Disney movie would do any of this. I mean, we'll find out, because Elio is a sci-fi movie that, of course, costs 10 times as much as this one does. And we'll see that this summer. But I don't know if I'll find something that was as fun as this was, because, like, it's one thing to be weird and wacky and kind of like artistic, but it's another thing to deliver a movie that's actually a lot of fun. And I think that's what I was so shocked and surprised by, which I really shouldn't have been, is that this fucking thing at 90 minutes flies by. And it's a lot of fun. Like, and they get Porky and Daffy right. They get these two.
I mean, characters. It's weird that they're the only two in it.
Oh, and Petunia.
Petunia. Yeah. There's no other Looney Tune character in it. Like, none. Not a hint at one of them. Like, just these three characters. Which is also what I like. It's funny. Like, immediately I was like, this feels like something that was created for streaming and got a theatrical release. So knowing that it was created for Max, like, actually makes sense, because, again, not that I didn't enjoy it, but I can't see the head of a studio greenlighting a Looney Tunes movie that doesn't feature the most famous Looney Tune.
Yeah, which is Bugs, right?
So, in some way, shape, or form. Doesn't have to be the main character, but, like, how are we going to have a fucking Looney Tunes movie and Bugs Bunny's not in it?
This is true. But I will say something. I'm going to make a statement that I feel like might be controversial, but maybe not. Maybe this is the way that most people feel. I feel like having Bugs as a character in any movie makes the movie narratively inert. Because of who Bugs is, like, he's somebody that doesn't lose. And if you have somebody that doesn't lose, there's no narrative. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The thing that I liked about Porky and, like, the thing that I love about Porky.
I mean, they are loser characters. Like, their existence is built on them being losers, like, from the jump.
Exactly. So. And it gives you a narrative, like, it gives you narrative to do stuff, right? Like, it gives their relationship narrative, like, a narrative part. Because, like, that's the whole thing that ends up happening in the movie, and that like...
What the fucking Armageddon ending, man? What the fuck?
I mean, like, everything about this, like they use REM. Like, they use REM.
Better than the REM. Cutaway or like needle drop is the fucking Bryan Adams needle drop.
Oh my god. Oh man, laughter aplenty. Like that was like both of them were like hilarious and like again, like speaks to the WTF of it, but when you really think about it, Looney Tunes is WTF,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like my favorite Looney Tune things ever, and it's probably most people's, is Duck Amuck. Because Duck Amuck is so WTF. It's so kind of like it breaks so many rules about animation, including breaking the fourth wall with Daffy and his animator being each other's enemies, right? Like
yeah.
It's the like I feel like that literally is what Monty Python based their entire career off of, is Duck Amuck. But it also kind of like that sets the standard for like what you get when you have a Daffy Duck like thing, right?
But and the whole like thing of this movie is trying to find a way to cage the lunacy that is Daffy Duck. And then yeah. Ultimately being like, oh, that's, you can't do that. You have to let him be this, you know, chaotic thing to get where you need to go. Yeah, it's really, it's such an interesting thing. I can't say I enjoyed like every second of it. I didn't hate any of it though. I really wish that you have a chance to have it's an alien storyline, and maybe it's just because I'm so partial to the one fucking space traveling character from the Looney Tunes. To not have it be Marvin the Martian is kind of upsetting for me. But he is my favorite Looney Tune. I mean, on my left, as we're podcasting, is a Marvin the Martian Lego figure, a Marvin the Martian pop, and a Marvin the Martian figure from the Space Jam 2 movie. So, like, it's the only Looney Tune stuff I have. I love Marvin the Martian. So that was a little, like, oh, man. Like, I can't believe you didn't do Marvin. I can kind of understand, like, leaving everybody else out. But that was the one, because it was so space-based, that was, But, you know, it is what it is. I think the alien character they have is fun. Like, it's a lot of fun. And the whole... the boba tea thing was such a weird pull.
It really was. Like the way that they approach the invasion is so fucking wild to begin with. So that everything else that happens in that is so kind of like allowing them to go off the deep end. It's kind of hilarious, right? So like everything that happens, like the boba tea, the weird flavor that she's looking for. Like everything
that it's chewing gum at all is bizarre. Like it feels like a reference to something, but I don't know what. Like I want to say they live, but it can't be that, you know, because that's such a like nothing line in They Live. But I mean, everybody knows it, but like, you know, I'm here to chew gum and kick ass and I'm all out of bubble gum. But there's no way that that's what that's a reference to, like, because that has nothing to do with the, like, the zombie thing. So, no. I don't know. Like, this is one of those things where it's like, I wish we were in the good old DVD days, because this would have a creator's commentary track with like them breaking down like all their influences, or at least a 30 minute behind the scenes doc where they discuss like all the films that they're kind of like drawing inspiration from. Some are real easy to pinpoint, and some are like, I know this is referencing something that I probably haven't seen.
No, absolutely. Like there is a Blu-ray that's coming out, but I don't know what kind of special features that are going to be on it. But I do know.
In this day and age, man, I
know.
Even Marvel DVDs are like, oh, we have like three special features. And I'm like, man, I miss the good old days.
You know, And if you're not getting a Criterion or a Scream or Shout Factory, yeah, you're not getting anything else.
And they can't fucking put out everything. So.
Nope. No, they really can't. So,
we're still, at this point, we're still having to pay $30 for these things, you know? Like, but, I mean, I enjoyed the movie. Stephanie saw it with me. She enjoyed it as well. Like, it's weird that going to see this movie is like an act of defiance against the studio that produced it, not distributed it, but produced it. but like you can kind of see that like Warner Brothers Zaslav specifically doesn't really want this to succeed.
No.
And somehow it's made $8 million in what, 2 weeks?
Yep.
So so much so that Ketchup is now trying to buy Coyote versus Acme out from underneath Warner Brothers and release it.
Which I feel like if this is what they got with no marketing, if they can find a way to get a marketing budget for Acme versus Coyote and they get the stars.
The thing about Acme versus Coyote is that everybody that was involved with the movie feels passionately about it.
Yeah.
And while you might have to pony up money for them to do press for it, like, they wouldn't be unwilling to. It's not like Madam Web where the stars are like, yeah, we're not really fucking doing press for this. This is bullshit. Yeah. Everybody involved with that movie feels positively passionate about it, and if they can do press for it, they will do press for it. Like this movie, there's no star in it. There's not a star in the movie. Like the voice actors are voice actors, other than like Wayne Knight, who's in it for like two lines, and Fred Tatasciore, who nobody knows as a household name. You only know his name if you pay attention to voice actors. Like, those are the two biggest, probably, names. And Wayne Knight, if you don't know his name, it's only you know him if you see him. So there's not a way to do press for this movie. Like, you have to just run promotion for it. Whereas Coyote versus Acme has a litany of stars in it, and they can do press for it. So, yeah, if you can do $7 million in 2 weeks off something that has very little promotion and no press, then, yeah, a movie with stars in it that will do press for your movie, yeah, like, if they can, what was the, you saw it, right? Is it $10 million they're trying to get it for?
No, it's 50.
$50 million. Oh, shit.
Yeah. Warner Brothers wants 50 for it. Which tells you, like, here's the thing.
That also tells you that they know what the fuck they got.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just fucking Zaz, man. Like, you know.
Either that or that's more than what. I don't know how the tax write off thing works. Like, they can sell it and it still be a tax write off. Like, I don't know how that works.
I have no idea. Like, I really honestly don't. I don't know if they've taken the write-off yet.
Right. So, because like, it's only been a year since they officially canceled, a year.
Yeah. And I think that they have to prove, in order for it to be a tax write-off, they have to prove and justify that it will lose money.
Basically, maybe if it's the $50 million that would be the tax write-off, but they can sell it for 50, it equals the same thing.
Exactly. Or the tax write-off is 30 or 25 and they're selling it for 50 because they don't want to be embarrassed if the movie makes a ton of money. Because
you sell it for 50 and it only makes 60, you don't look that bad. You sell it for 30 and it makes 70, you look like a fucking idiot.
Exactly. And the numbers are such that people say, like, a $50 million movie with the PNR and all that stuff, you have to make 150 in order to break a profit.
Yeah.
So Ketchup will have to have made, like, if they do eventually buy it for $50 million,
they would have. I don't know if it could do 150.
if you release it in summer and you do a PNR campaign, the right PNR campaign, and you get Tina to promote the shit out of it.
Yeah. I mean, it might could.
Yeah.
But that seems like a steep ask, and you know, I feel like, well, Mickey 17 didn't have a shit ton of marketing either, because that movie is not going to make its money back.
No, it's going to be released next week on PVOD.
Yeah.
And that'll, like, all they need, like here's the shittiest part, is that because it goes on PVOD, there's no advertising for it, and if they just sell a million downloads, that's $24 million extra that they can just swap up, that they only have to share a little bit of with the stars because everybody got fucked over streaming rights.
Yeah.
You know? So, just another way that they can con people out of money.
So, you know, I know we hadn't talked a ton about the movie, but I mean, what is there to say? It's fun.
Yeah.
What I know we're right at our mark, but very briefly, like, we also had in the last 2 weeks Warner Brothers removing basically all of, not only are the Looney Tunes discs that were released in the early 2000s probably just glorified coasters right now because of the fucking materials that they used, they also pulled all of it off of streaming, so you can't really access the Looney Tunes library. I know that there's some Blu-rays out there and there's some more coming, but it's not the extensive collection that we had on DVD. Furthering what I said to start this, they don't know what the fuck to do with these characters, and they haven't for a very, very long time. So much in the same way that they had to really bring in two people, one to handle the business side of it, one to handle the creative side of it for their other property that they couldn't figure out what the fuck to do with DC Comics. Are we now looking at a situation where they might consider, like, okay, Ketchup seems to know what to do with these properties. We're farming them out to you.
I don't know, dude. Because here's the thing, is that I'm a huge Looney Tunes fan. Like, the first thing that I did that when you told me about The Rock was, so, like, there are very few DVDs I have. I have mostly Blu-rays. But the DVDs, like, the ones that I have, you know what they are? The Warner Brothers Looney Tunes. And the first thing I did was started to play them and then transfer them over to a digital format, because I have a lot of those Blu-ray or DVDs that they will never release. Like, what's his name? Speedy Gonzalez stuff?
Yeah.
Gone.
It will
just be gone.
Yeah.
It's like Song of the South, right? Like, we will never see a release of Song of the South. It's just too racist and too fucked up. And Speedy Gonzalez is like one of those things.
Yeah, even in Trump's America.
Yeah.
They're going to be like, we don't want that bad press.
Yeah, we don't want that bullshit. So, like, I just started to full cloth, like, pull over into a digital sphere. The Looney Tunes DVDs that I have, which are about, I have about 10 of them. Right, which amount to about, I think right now it's hovering at like 7 hours, and I've only gotten through like 4 of them. So, like, I'm gonna have a bunch of them. I also have the Blu-rays. I'm cool. I'm good because I can always watch them. But the thing is, the thing that worries me is like kids are never going to see these things. Like, yeah. We grew up Saturday morning. What did we watch?
Yeah, it was. You know, that was part of the rotation, you know, and every couple of months they would have a new movie that would like some new animation and like stitch together old animation. And, you know, it's just, I don't know, in a world where Disney constantly finds ways to reinvent Mickey and like reinsert him into pop culture, the fact that the Warner Brothers studio can't figure out what the fuck to do with the Looney Tunes characters is baffling to me.
Well, I mean, like, think about it. Like, as soon as they sold their theme parks, it was
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Like, their theme parks kept those characters alive for so fucking long. Like, I mean, how do you not make a Space Jam 2 with Michael Jordan after Space Jam first came out?
Yeah, it took years, and you get LeBron, and it's direct to fucking Max, and it's not yeah. anything remotely as, yeah. And I don't even love the first Space Jam, but like it worked for the era, you know, yeah. like them working with Disney to create the world of Roger Rabbit and include the Looney Tunes characters into it. It's been a very long time since they knew what to do. I mean, we even had like the Tiny Toons growing up
yeah.
that, you know, kind of reinvigorated all of that and helped reestablish Warner Brothers as an animated studio, and all that's gone. It's just all gone. And it's just kind of sad, man. Like, if these characters just go away, it's just sad.
It really is, because their cultural imprint is massive. Like, and then to see it wiped out in the span of like basically 30 years, right? Space Jam Part 1.
It's not even the span of it's not even like it's the span of a lifetime. It's such a short amount of time. Mm-hmm. Such a short amount of time.
It really is. Like, in a way that just is disgusting to me.
Like, you know, there's shit from the like 30s and 40s that you just can't see anymore because of whatever. And, you know, that's been damn near 100 years. And it does suck that stuff is gone. But, like, that's over the course of a lifetime.
Yeah.
This is just a couple of decades. And it's like Bugs Bunny. Who?
Yeah. Like, it's not going to have it. And then, like, I don't know, man. Like, it's a very weird thing to watch happen. Something so culturally important is erased away. But also, like, the weirder part is, like, and it speaks to something larger, is I feel like, so, like, if we look at Disney, was always a little wholesome. I mean, yes, of course, there are some stuff that, like, I actually still have that's extremely racist, but I feel like the Looney Tunes, because of the kind of, like, because of their tone and the way that they approach things, they were a lot more what would be considered culturally inappropriate now. And,
yeah.
like, was for a long time. So, like, you know, the wild thing is I don't think that people know that there are, like, Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny cartoons with racist black caricatures.
Oh, like, and Native Americans.
And Native Americans and Mexican, like,
Hispanic,
Latino,
yeah.
Like, Asian. Like, yeah. And I'm talking stuff that if you saw it now, you would turn bright red.
It's a little rough. But, like, I feel like we're kind of similar in the, like, yes, but it's also a product of its time. And, like,
does
forgetting it existed or erasing it from existence do anything remotely healthy? Like,
no, it doesn't. Know? It sanitizes. It gets you to the point where, it gets you to the fucking point where people believe that we can make America great and going back to the 1950s.
Yeah.
That's what it takes us to.
And as if the terrible shit in the 50s wasn't there.
Exactly.
It's just like,
no, it was absolutely there.
What?
There were like, still lynchings. There were still, goddamn, polio was still a fucking thing.
I mean, like, it's part of the problem the way, I mean, we're getting on the soapbox, but the way we were taught history is, you know, like, I mean, I bring this up probably too many times, but like, Abraham Lincoln was the greatest president we've ever had because of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yep.
But in the same breath he was doing that, he okayed the slaughter of thousands and thousands, if not million, natives of this fucking country. Yeah. And it's just like, but we aren't taught that in school. You're taught about the feel good shit. And
which I don't get. How do we have, where did we go? Like I remember that. Like, and
it would be like going to Germany and finding out that they just don't teach this giant section of German history. Like, oh, we don't talk about it. That didn't happen.
Oh, no, like, they absolutely what? Do.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. They do.
But it's like,
we get away from that. And we think if we erase the negative shit, we can just pretend like we're not those people who created fucking racist cartoons. We don't publish those Dr. Seuss books anymore. Like, I mean, I guess I kind of get it, but also, like, erasing it from existence doesn't fucking do anything.
No!
It doesn't. It really doesn't. It doesn't show you, like, it makes, because what you want to do is be like, oh, well, we were never racially insensitive when we absolutely were and still are.
Exactly. And worse, back then, there was fucking massive fucking violence perpetrated on people. And it's like, oh, okay, well let's just, like, and I know this is weird and you guys are gonna like, oh, yeah
we got Norms to a bit of a soapbox, but like you said, like, you go back and watch those old cartoons and it's just like, oh, wow. Like, yeah, it's like watching All in the Family. Like, you watch it and you're just like, holy shit, I can't believe a character on TV, on a network television show is saying stuff like this. But, we need, like, that's the shit we need to stop erasing from existence and just add a, like, this is of the era. Like, I was actually discussing this with a friend of mine kind of this past weekend, because Columbus is next to a military base, which was called Fort Benning, named for a racist asshole in the past. They renamed it like several years ago to Fort Moore because they wanted to get away from that, and now they're renaming it back to Fort Benning. So really all we've done is waste a lot of money renaming something. And I'm like, they should have never changed it to begin with. And he's pretty right wing. He's like, I can't believe you feel that way. I'm like, why are we renaming it? Why the fuck are we trying to forget that something was there? Like, put up a fucking sign and just be like, here is who this guy was. And we're, this is history. Like, maybe the base should be named after him. Maybe it shouldn't. You can think whatever you want to think, but we're not going to spend millions of dollars changing, because it's not like just changing the sign out front. It's a military base. You have to change so many things. But, like, I it's that whole, like, why are we trying to erase this from existence? I don't agree in embracing it and being like, this is a good thing, but stop trying to erase this shit. And what's sad about the Looney Tunes stuff, to bring it back around, is it's a financial decision, which actually makes it worse. But I don't know. I hope that somebody can step in and rescue this. I know Warner's is never going to give up something there's a reason we're getting this the Harry Potter stuff, because they don't want to give up a property that they own because they have to find a way to monetize it.
Yep.
But they haven't been able to find a way to really monetize the Looney Tunes. And when they try, they get it wrong. So hopefully somebody can step in.
That is my hope. Like, somebody that actually cares. Like, in a perfect world, they would give carte blanche to Joe Dante, because, like, of anybody, I feel like he is the man that loves and cares for these characters. And then maybe somebody else like that's more of an artistic person.
Yeah.
Now I know like Dante's in his like in his early 70s, but like, you know, there's a bunch of fucking people that are in their mid 70s that are running things and they're old white people and they just don't give a shit. At least he cares, right?
Yeah.
But it's my hope. It is my profound hope that they do find a way to like maintain this. Does that make sense? Like it's yeah. one thing to like I don't know, man. Like it's really fucking shitty to me that like we went from like in our age, do you remember like how much we used to wear Looney Tunes stuff and how cool it was? Like, yeah. And we're talking about like not even just like elementary school, but we're talking junior high and high school.
Tasmanian Devil was every fucking wear.
Yeah. Okay, Marvin the Martian. Who didn't wear a Marvin the Martian shirt like in high school? Like
I had several of them. So
exactly.
Yeah.
I did too. Like
Bugs was everywhere. And it's just almost gone. And that's just really sad. So
mm-hmm.
yeah. Hopefully if it's not catch up, hopefully it's somebody can step in and rescue should be a continuing like thing like every few years, the way Disney is with Mickey. Like I know it's not going to be like that wholesome Mickey thing that they do, but like there's I mean $8 million isn't great, but it's not a fucking drop in the, like somebody is still watching the Looney Tunes. We went to a 12:40 matinee to see this movie mm-hmm. on the second week of its release, and we weren't the only people in the theater. Like
Right? Like, I saw it on opening day, a 4 o'clock show. I mean, I had my Stubbs membership, but then that means that, like, my 4 o'clock show is literally a regular price show. And there were at least 40 people in a 100 seat theater. In the smallest theater in my theater, it was half full.
And I mean, there weren't but like maybe 10 people in our theater, but still, on a Saturday afternoon, the second week of its release, for a movie that has no promotion, like, mm-hmm. you know, in a small ass town, like, you know, that ain't nothing, man. So yeah, somebody's got to, anyway, yeah, go see it. If you've listened to this, you haven't seen it, go see it. It's a lot of fun. It's a, like I said, it's a weird love letter to like paranoid sci-fi films from like the 50s through the 80s. And like weird 90s animation. It is such a odd pull, but it really is. For the most part, it really works. So
yeah. And as a Looney Tunes fan, like I can tell you honestly, like I really loved it. I enjoyed it. I'm gonna buy it on I have been very restrictive. I'm gonna buy it on Blu-ray.
I'm going to see what's on the Blu-ray. I may find if there's nothing worthwhile, then I will own a copy of it, I'm sure. But I don't know if there's not going to be anything worth me owning the Blu-ray. I might just, you know, have myself a digital copy of it that they can't take away from me. So
there's nothing wrong with that, man. There is nothing wrong with that.
Anyway, so next week we may or may not be talking Death of a Unicorn. I'm probably going to see it Friday. That's the plan.
I'm gonna try to see if I can get to it.
We'll definitely be talking the 2-part Daredevil thing though. So big gemstones thing.
And who knows? We might be talking the Residents.
If we can get to it this weekend, yeah, that's the hope. So, until then, you can go check out everything else we do over at xwingfiles.com, or you can go read our written work over at Adam's website.
Yes, that is themovieowl.com, where I've got a ton of reviews up. Borderline, which we just talked about, I have a full-on review of that. I've got a lot of 4K stuff. I've got still more 4K stuff to come in the coming upcoming weeks, so just be on the lookout, themovieowl.com.
And we will see you guys next week. Number 4, Mario, number 5, Weird Al, number 6, Batman, number 7, Cal, number 8, Simpsons, number 9, TV, number 10, every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but before they all sold out, see it all together if you're with me now.